Hi friends, it's Brittany. Before we dive into today's episode, I have a quick ask for you. I need your help. I'm doing a short listener survey to get to know you a little bit better. Who's tuning in? What do you love? And how I can keep Conscious Pathways fresh, meaningful, and aligned with what you need. It won't take more than 5 minutes, and your feedback means so much to me. It helps me grow and helps this podcast to grow with you. You'll find the link in the show notes, and I would be so grateful if you took a moment to share your thoughts. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And now let's get into the episode.
30% of the CSU teacher preparation programs are still using that to teach. Ooh. Yes. Okay. And we know from research that that does not work, and it's being used. And that's what's being taught to teacher preparation programs, pre-service teachers.
Hello and welcome to Conscious Pathways, a podcast where we explore the intersection of education and social justice through transformative conversations. I'm your host, Brittany, and I am so excited to have you here today. I do want to give a special shout out to my Patreon subscribers. Hello, Patreon subscribers who get this podcast episode early. You also get access to Ask an Expert, where you can ask me or one of my special guests a question that I can answer live on the podcast here, along with a whole lot of other special goodies. So if you're curious about that, you can check out the show notes below and check out Patreon. Today, I am joined by Dr. Denise Kennedy. Dr. Denise Kennedy is a professor and department chair of early childhood studies at California State Polytechnic University in Pomona. She holds a master's degree in clinical psychology and marriage and family therapy and a PhD in human and community development from the University of Illinois. She completed a postdoctoral research fellowship at the University of Michigan in developmental psychology and contributed to the longitudinal study on family transitions. Dr. Kennedy's research centers on enhancing the social and emotional development of children and families in the context of sibling, parent-child, and marital relationships, with a particular attention to how children learn to regulate emotions. The scope of her research has expanded recently to focus on parents' and teachers' efficacy and the belief that they will be able to work successfully with young children. This new research is also focused on dual language learner competencies and college students' sense of belonging. Dr. Kennedy has such an inspiring background in research and in education. She has such a passion for education and teaching students, especially around early childhood education. So it was just such a wonderful conversation to have. So let's hop into it. Welcome to Conscious Pathways. I am joined by Dr. Denise Kennedy. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Brittany. It's my pleasure to be here.
I am so excited. This is so great. is it really cloudy where you guys are right
yes.
now?
Yes. Yes. It's cloudy and it's in the low 60s.
Oh, same.
Same?
Same. We have... Yeah. June gloom, which I think it's kind of all over Southern California, but just the June gloom, it's glooming.
So. Yeah, it's definitely that.
Yes. I'm excited to get more sunshine, but also taking advantage of the not questionable amounts of heat. So
yes,
I'll take it easy for now.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you got your start in education and kind of what interests you specifically around early childhood education?
Absolutely. I started with the idea that I wanted to become a clinical psychologist, and I received my master's degree in clinical psychology and marriage family therapy, and I was doing therapy in elementary schools. So I did art and play therapy with children, and I loved being in that context. Mm-hmm. But my personality is one that I could not leave work at home. So I worried. Yep. I worried about the children. It gave me a huge respect for the teachers and what they do week in and week out, because I was basically the person on the school grounds that any disruptive child in a classroom was sent to me. And it wasn't
must have been
so,
very busy then.
it Yeah, this was a while ago. So it was really interesting in that things that teachers do not have the bandwidth for. You know, you have a large classroom of children, and if someone's disrupting that, so it enabled me to find things such as, you know, during reading, a child might act out, and he didn't need to see me as the therapist or counselor, but he needed to go to the reading specialist because he could not read.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the teachers some teachers, you know, do this, but some don't have the time to discern, you know, what is happening with this child. And in addition to that, you know, you have the very emotional, the very difficult family life of children. So there were kids I had that I had no idea if I would see them the next week, if they would be alive. You know, it was that bad. And it wore on me. So I decided to go back and get my PhD. And I decided I would create intervention programs to help children, but then also teach others to work with the children directly. So I didn't have an ulcer if I continued to do what I was doing, but I really loved it. You know, it was heartbreaking. It was very heartbreaking, you know, and so I got my PhD and I created a program. It's called the More Fun with Sisters and Brothers program. And it's for siblings, but it really focuses on teaching children how to regulate emotion and how to take perspective. And I did it in the context of the sibling relationship because that's the most volatile relationship. So if you can get along with your sibling, you can get along with anybody, and it will translate into every relationship in your life. So that's why I did that. It's
I feel that.
Yeah. And I worked with 4 to 8, 4 to 9 year olds in my intervention. So it was a 6-week intervention with lots of home visits. And I did that at the University of Illinois. It's still running. And my advisor actually started it as an online program for parents and families.
Oh, wow.
And then I did a postdoctoral fellowship, and I did that at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And I worked on a study. It's called the Family Transition Study. And it was really a really developmental study. So it was basically looking at when a mother's pregnant with her second child. And then the first year when that baby's born, I think we had like 10 home visits or 10 visits with the families. And we did everything from the strange situation to see what the attachment was like. We did it with mothers and with fathers.
Okay.
And then we did a lot of other things, like how does empathy develop? How does sympathy develop in children? What is their self-concept like? So most of my experience has been developmental in nature and also assessment in nature. And I did not start out thinking I wanted to be an educator, but when you are in a doctoral program, you have to teach and you have to do research. And I am very much introverted. And so standing up in front of a classroom was not my ideal job, but I found that I always knew more than my students did because I prepared. And so it gave me a little ease and peace of mind and not so much stress. It probably took about 5 or 6 years before I didn't get butterflies before every class. But I found that, so I am the one person in my program that has not been a teacher in a classroom. So I've been in elementary classrooms, middle school classrooms, but more in the context of observing, you know, or doing assessments or doing the therapy outside of the class. So I'll pull the children out of the classroom and then go to the therapy room. So it's something that I think is so important to understand a child. And one of the things, you know, when I teach in my courses, most of my students now at Cal Poly Pomona want to be teachers. And when I teach the basic development class, child growth and development is in California is kind of the basic foundational class that has the theories. But I let them know that a child is not born bad, or a child is not born disruptive. And so it's so important to understand every context of that child, you know, their family, where do they live? You know, what is their culture? Who's the support around them? You know, are there supports around them? Things like that. And so having that in-depth understanding is so important in a classroom, you know, with children. And sometimes the child just needs one adult. And research shows that, you know, children are very resilient, but having that one adult there that they can feel safe with and trust and talk to can make a huge difference in the world. And so those are the types of things I try to impart on my students as they go out into the field to teach.
Yes. I think that's one of the most beautiful things about education is that it can happen in a variety of contexts, right? So when we think about teaching, we usually just think about being in the classroom and that's how you make the impact on the students. But there are so many people within the school community that also interact with these children and also have, you know, really profound interactions and really profound impact from, you know, the janitorial staff, from the, you know, the kitchen staff and the principal, assistant principal, the admin, right? Like everyone who's, you know, in that environment interacts with the children in some way and can make a really meaningful impact on their lives. And I think that's the beauty of it when we kind of, you know, move our lens out a little bit on like what it means to teach. Like our community is a part of our teaching practice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we talk about a little bit more in the early childhood sphere. And like you said, the development, we talk a lot about development. We talk a lot about theory in early childhood. And it gives us like this really well-rounded understanding of where this child is coming from.
Yeah. I mean, it's the whole child, right? We look at the whole child. And I think that's the biggest difference between early childhood and our K-12 system. And I keep every meeting I'm at now, when people say K-12, I always correct them and say, I'm sorry, it's TK-12 now. We're in California, it's TK-12. You need to remember the early childhood kids because they're part of it now.
Yep, they are a part of it now. And, you know, that's part of the reason how, you know, we came to meet each other was at a conference and we were talking about TK. And as you mentioned with California, you know, we've expanded our TK. We've been doing TK for a couple of years, but we have expanded it now for all 4-year-olds to have access to transitional kindergarten, which is now a part of the school district. So they're, you know, they're in there now.
Yeah, they're there.
And so they're there. And so it's so important that we are being mindful and that we are talking about, you know, our early childhood. And as, you know, we know, early childhood extends, you know, even further into, you know, the school year. So up to about third grade, it's usually around that early childhood, you know, age range. And so I love that we're having more conversations about early childhood and that we're engaging in more of these, like, let's talk about the development. Let's talk about, you know, these young children and not just 4-year-olds. Like, I know we need to talk about 3-year-olds, because just because you turned 4 yesterday does not mean that you're going to act like a 4-year-old today.
Exactly. And, you know, there are districts that are enrolling 3-year-olds into TK.
Yes. Yeah. Which is, it's a thing.
Scary. I'm sorry. It's scary. It scares me.
It is. That scares me too. I feel deeply concerned, especially with how the rollout of TK has gone thus far this past like year or so. It's just kind of happened. And I feel like we needed to take a couple of steps before we just started enrolling 4-year-olds into TK, and we didn't take those steps. We are looking at making those steps now. So, you know, I think the state of California is recognizing that, you know, okay, there's some people who need to be in the room. There's some things we need to put in place. So they're making some changes that will, you know, overall happen over the next couple of years. But, you know, as an early childhood educator, I'm looking at this and I'm saying, well, yeah, but there's children in those classrooms right now, like today. It's great that, you know, in a year or two from now, you have, you know, these things going into effect and all, you know, TK educators are going to have these, you know, these classes and all of the people who are interacting with this age range are going to have this training. that's amazing. I want to see that, but I need to see that today.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. So, do you want to give the audience a little bit of an overview of kind of the current state in early childhood education and what we've been doing, you know, in California for TK and kind of where we are in general right now?
There's so much. I don't know where to start. One of the things I think that I've been working on and a lot of my colleagues have been working on is this PK through third grade. I think it's called PK through third grade early childhood education specialist instruction credential. It's like a mouthful.
It's always a mouthful.
Yeah. And so I'm just going to short it to PK3 credential.
Perfect.
That has been happening over the last several years. And it was approved by the Office of Administrative Law for April 1st. And with that, programs, and when I say programs, I mean higher ed programs, are submitting proposals to the California Commission on Teacher Credentialing to approve that so that that institution can offer that credential. Mm-hmm. Child development programs at the baccalaureate level are the ones that will meet subject matter for that credential. So that is the preferred pathway, is a bachelor's degree in, so an associate's degree from a community college or a freshman coming into a bachelor's program where there are, you know, classes in child development. And then that BA program, you can then go into the credential program. Now, the way this credential was rolled out, and I think I mentioned this in my presentation, it was to appease, and I think like anything, politics plays a role in every decision that's made. Often, again, the implementation of it is not well thought out, and there are many issues with this credential. The first is that there are two options. So I said option one is where child development programs meet subject matter as the root and the base of this credential. The second option is for multiple subject credential holders to take any 24 units, and then they can apply for that credential and get it. And it's 24 units in child development, and it could be anything that would not be relevant to them teaching in that TK classroom, but it counts because it says it's a child development class. So it could be how to write a resume in child development, and that would count. That has been one of the things that has really impacted us in higher ed in many ways. Many liberal studies programs. So liberal studies meets the subject matter for the multiple subject credential.
Okay.
And there was legislation passed, AB 130, Assembly Bill 130, where if your degree program is called liberal studies, liberal arts, or elementary education, those students do not have to take the CSET exam, which is the exam that has three parts that meet subject matter. So the commission is trying to reduce barriers for teachers, potentially. And we know these high stakes tests are barriers oftentimes, and they're very expensive. So what a lot of programs want is, for example, the liberal studies programs might want my program to create some 24 units for their students. But because what I can offer them, because they're not in my program, are lower division, meaning more basic type of courses versus our upper division that go into depth and breadth, where we actually give our students in higher ed pedagogical skills. This is how you teach algebra to a child. This is, you know, this is how you teach a child to read. We give those pedagogical skills. So the student in my classroom has to understand math and science and language and literacy, but they also have to be given skills to teach them.
Yep.
And that's the biggest difference. And I think that's what's missing. And that's where many of us have been advocating to push up early childhood into the primary grades versus this push down that's happened. And that's kind of mm-hmm. what's been happening.
Yeah.
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 That's the main thing that we've been focusing on. Legislatively, there has been so much funding going into LEAs or the school districts. Mm-hmm. They've been given so much money for early childhood, for TK in particular. And I don't know what it's been utilized for, honestly.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, but you know, I think the idea was they were going to get 13,000 teachers that they needed to mm-hmm. fill that school year last year, and they didn't even come close to that number. So the governor pulled back mm-hmm. some of that funding, rather than allocate that for infrastructure and things that yeah. schools need. You know, furniture for 3 and 4 year olds, yeah. bathrooms for them, things like mm-hmm. that. That was not done. So I think that's something that needs to get worked on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the infrastructure part, like we talked about, they, you know, TK's been around for a minute, but now it's available for all 4-year-olds and even some 3-year-olds. And, you know, I don't know many 3-year-olds who are extremely proficient on using the bathroom 100% on their own, like, you know, with the wiping and everything, who don't need any specific help. Oftentimes they do still need a little bit of assistance with these types of things. And, you know, within the school district, you just can't. You know, that's the kind of different than in early childhood. In early childhood, we're still able to help, you know, toileting and things like that if yes. they need it. Yes. But once they're in the school district, you know, the teachers just aren't able to do that.
Yeah. Or they refuse. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Or refuse it. And, you know, then you just have, you know, these very concerning situations with these very young children. And like, yeah. you know, they're trying, but, you know, developmentally, they're, you know, they're still working on the motor skills. Yes. They're still working on, you know, the strategies to be able to do that on their own, but they're still learning, right? They've only right. been on this planet for like 3 or 4 years. Like, it takes time.
Yes, you're absolutely you know? Right. Yes.
It takes time. And just the infrastructure on that, you know, the thought of like, okay, you're just going to give, you know, a pass to this, you know, 4-year-old to go to the bathroom, but the bathroom's not close to the classroom. So, you know, they're having to traverse down hallways to get to where they need to go to use these bathrooms that aren't developmentally, you know, their right. size.
Exactly. And then you have the eight or nine-year-old in that classroom too. And mm-hmm. you know, how does that, it's scary. It's a scary thing. You know, I worry about yeah. trauma and right yes. now for these kids.
Exactly. I worry about that a lot too. Thinking about just the developmentally appropriate practices that, you know, may or may not be happening, because we've seen the push down, exactly what you were mentioning, these kind of push down of educators from, you know, and now kindergarten is essentially the new first grade. And, you know, I don't want TK to become the new kindergarten. It's, you know, where we're just doing things like we're teaching them to read, we're doing all these different things. And it's like, okay, but are we doing this in ways that are developmentally appropriate? Like, are they actually, do they have the 4 foundational skills to be successful in that? And what kind of trauma is that going to cause? Because there are some kids who can excel in these very academic, very rigid, you know, environments. Right. And that's just the way that their brains work. And that's, you know, fine. But that's not going to work for every single child.
No.
So I'm just thinking about the long-term impacts on, you know, their love for learning, their love for school, just kind of getting squashed at such an early age because they're looking at all their other peers and like, I just can't do that. I can't sit in my desk for this prolonged period of right. time and keep my hands to myself. And, you know, then you're seeing, you know, kids getting, you know, sent to the principal's office more often, or they're getting sent to, like you mentioned earlier, they're getting sent to the school psychologist more often, and right. just kind of getting pushed out of the school environment and the school community. And it's like, where's that learning coming from?
One of the things that's so important too are naps. You know, yes. 4-year-olds need a nap.
Yeah.
And if you're going to have a full day classroom, that needs to be a consideration. And I don't yeah. know, I haven't had anecdotes. I had 1 or 2. I don't know if it's across the board, but I don't know that these current teachers in the workforce that are not child development mm-hmm. you know, majors as they became a teacher, that they understand the importance. You know, all your kids are going to be acting up in the afternoon. Why?
Yep.
Why do you think that is? Well, I think they might need a nap.
So
things, just subtle things of understanding, you know, mm-hmm. a child's brain and understand the physicality. They need to move. They need mm-hmm. to be able to transition into other centers and areas in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And that's not always happening, which is unfortunate.
Yes. So in your experience kind of working with families and districts and, you know, legislation and all of those things, what have been some successful strategies that you have seen that either school districts are doing, that either teachers are doing, that are kind of supporting early childhood education?
That's a great question. And I know that what I've said so far has been very negative, and I don't mean it to be, mm-hmm. but that's the state of what it is. But there are districts that are really doing things appropriately, such as I think Ventura County has been working with the early childhood program, so preschool programs, mm-hmm. with the school district, so that when TK classrooms are over, they will transition those children into a preschool center for the rest of the day until parents get off work and can pick them up, because that wraparound care is missing a lot.
Yes.
And, you know, kids are out on the playground with all of the other kids at the school. You know, they're going up to fifth grade, all the fifth graders, everybody's there.
Yeah.
And it's scary. And they don't have playgrounds that are developmentally appropriate for them and the size, things like that. So there are districts that are doing that. Some districts already have preschool classrooms in their, mm-hmm. within their districts. And so they have classrooms that have bathrooms in the classroom, and they've been built that way. So I think San Diego was one that really tried to incorporate more of the universal preschool type of model into the TK. And they brought in where classrooms were co-taught with the multiple subject teacher who maybe taught kindergarten, and then the lead preschool teacher in one of the classrooms to work together to teach. The downside of that model has been the preschool teacher has taken the lead, because they know how to teach a four-year-old. And we still see that pay disparity, because they're not getting paid what that credentialed teacher is getting paid, even though they are the expert in that room. So there's a lot of that. You know, it can be done. I think it has to involve collaboration, and it has to involve some type of thinking outside the box, because when we think of equity, there's so much of that not happening in this whole scenario. We know that in early childhood realm, the majority of teachers are teachers of color, and they're women. And in the school district realm, the majority of teachers are white women. And so how do we get more teachers of color into classrooms, especially for those communities where they would represent that community?
If you're like me, you believe in the power of education and social justice. And what's more powerful than a good book? Today, I want to share an incredible way for you to support local independent bookstores while you indulge in your love of reading. Have you ever heard of bookshop.org? They're an amazing platform that connects readers just like us to independent booksellers all around the world. Local bookstores are essential for our communities. They foster culture, curiosity, and a lifelong love of reading. But they need our support to thrive, especially in this age of e-commerce giants. Bookshop.org is committed to helping those bookstores flourish. Every purchase you make on their site financially supports independent bookstores. That's right, every single purchase. They provide these stores with the tools they need to compete online and maintain their vibrant presence in our neighborhoods. They put their mission and public good above financial interests, giving over 80% of their profit margin to independent bookstores. That's a commitment you don't see every day. In fact, in 2020, they were recognized as the best of the world by B Labs, ranking in the top 5% of all B corporations. And guess what? It's written into their government's documents that they will never sell the company to Amazon or any major retailer. That's dedication to their mission. Plus, as a climate-neutral company, they're committed to operating sustainably, another reason to feel good about your purchases. So if you're looking to buy a book and make a positive impact, head over to bookshop.org and use my affiliate link that's linked in my show notes below. By doing so, you'll be supporting local bookshops and helping them thrive. Let's make a difference one book at a time. Happy reading, and thank you for supporting our local bookshops.
I mean, yes. As a child, you want a teacher that looks like you. And and the hope is that that teacher will understand your context and see you as a whole child. And that doesn't always happen. You know, the other thing, one of the things that at my institution that we've been doing heavily is we do everything in our program to support multilingual learners because, you know, I think under 9-year-olds in the whole United States, the number is staggering at how many children under the age of 9, their home language is not English.
Wow.
And I think it's like 60%. It's really high.
Oh, my.
And in California, it's very high. And one of the things, you know, California is really bad in our education system. When you look at national rankings, we rank 42nd in the nation in our K-12. Last year, we ranked 50 in children being able to read by third grade. And we were single digits in our math scores.
Oof. That is rough, considering we used to be pretty, you know, on the, you know, the forefront of education in California. Like they kind of like the gold standard, they always used to say. And so to kind of, you know, see where we are in terms of the data, you know, and the data in the entire United States right now is abysmal, but like, you know.
I mean, that's why the focus has been on STEM, high focus on STEM, rightly so. We need to increase that. And then our literacy, you know, California's changed now that I don't remember the bill, but everyone's learning the science of reading. And I'm old enough where that's how I learned how to read. I mean, I'm a product of LA Unified School District, and I learned how to read with the science of reading. So it's not something new, but I know in California, a lot of people are pushing back against it. Like it's this new thing, and it's really not.
It's kind of just going back to kind of the OG way that you know, we used to with the phonics and the syntax and all of those things. And we kind of broke away from that over the last couple of years. I think it was like the 80s or 90s, maybe we broke into more like the balanced reading, and then we started doing 3 queuing for some reason. Don't ask me why. I don't know why that was a thing that we ever did.
and I have to say, I'm gonna call out my people that I think 30% of the CSU teacher preparation programs are still using that to teach. Ooh. Yes. Okay. And we know from research that does not work, and it's being used. And that's what's being taught to teacher preparation programs. Pre-service teachers are learning 3 queuing. So
no,
a lot needs to be changed. You know, a lot does. And it really does. And so my hope is that we can make enough noise to try to affect some change in our current education system in California in particular.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned something a little bit earlier about that wraparound care.
Yeah.
Because typically TK and kindergarten programs, they're usually half day. Sometimes you'll have the full day programs, but they're usually half day programs. And so, you know, we don't currently have, you know, buses that'll run for kids this age. And so it kind of creates this additional burden. So yes, it is a kind of, it's part of the school district, so it is free education. So like, you know, early childhood education, preschools are expensive. And, you know, I've talked about this before, but you really only get voice and choice in early childhood preschool education if you have, you know, the funds to do so. So if you're, you know, middle class or lower income, you don't really have a whole lot of options. You know, if you qualify for it, you can get, you know, CSPP, yeah, which is California State Preschool Programs, or you can get into Head Starts.
Right.
Or you can do like a family, you know, family, friend and neighbor type situation.
Right.
But other than that, you don't get much choice unless you are kind of like more upper middle class, middle, yeah, you know, and you have the money to choose like, oh, I want to go to a Reggio school, I want to go to Montessori. Like you get, yeah, more options. I know in some districts as well, they're also kind of pushing that kids have to go to TK. So, you know, some, yeah, parents literally don't get to have the choice, even if they want to have an extra year of preschool instead of TK.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hearing that parents kind of don't have a choice in that matter, which is also really concerning because I think that you should still have a choice.
Yeah.
It's still optional, but the fact that parents don't have a choice is concerning to me. But yeah, also that wraparound care. So if you don't have a choice, you have to do TK, but TK is only half day, but you know, you have to work your full day. So then you have to find, yes, you know, either after school programs for this age range, which is also harder to find, or you just have to figure something else out for the other half of that day, which causes an additional amount of issues for parents to find care that is developmentally appropriate.
Right.
You know, I've worked for programs that do after school programs, and they're usually not people who are qualified to, you know, teach children generally. They're usually, you know, kids who just got out of high school, or, you know, people who don't have background in education, which I think is fine in general, as long as you get the information, the developmental information on who you're dealing with. I think, right, you don't have to be a teacher to do after school care, but oftentimes they're not getting this additional information. And so it does make me even more concerned to think about after school care for these very young children. Like, where are they going? Who are they going to be with? Is it going to be like very mixed, like you were saying? Is it going to be fifth graders on the same playground with these newly, you know, 3 and 4 year olds who are so little?
Yeah.
You know, just so little. And, you know, what are we doing with these children? What is that wraparound care? What is that continuity of care looking like for these young children? And, you know, going back to what you mentioned before, what kind of trauma is going to be happening to these young children, especially if we don't have people who are qualified and know what they're doing when it comes to working with these very different age ranges?
Yes.
It's a lot.
it is a lot. And it's, you know, that's where I think the implementation and the rollout, mm-hmm, maybe was not as well thought out, because,
yes,
so much of this is part of early childhood, and, mm-hmm, and it's so important. And one of the struggles we have as a field, and this is not even just nationally, it's internationally, is that we're seen as caregivers and not as educators.
Yes. Yes.
And so we're not taken as professionals, and we're not taken as teacher preparation, even though that's exactly what we do. And I would say, yes, in my program that we do it better than some of the teacher preparation programs are doing. And I'm an undergraduate program, but I'm giving, mm-hmm, my students pedagogical skills.
Yes.
And I think that's so valuable, because when you understand a young child's brain and what, yes, they are able to learn and how they can learn at certain, mm-hmm, ages, you know exactly how to teach them.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, if you're just getting these general, you know, science of reading principles, mm-hmm, and what does that look like, you are not getting that in-depth learning of, okay, so with the science of reading, if I'm, you know, doing phonics, mm-hmm, what does that look like for this age, you know, for a 4 year old? What does it look, yes, like for a 6 year old? What does it look like for an 8 year old? And they are, mm-hmm, going to be different. But if you understand that, I think it makes teaching a little bit easier, because you, it know does, where to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember, you know, my first couple of years of like teaching in the classroom, and, you know, in California, you can still be getting your 12 units and start teaching, right, early childhood, which, that's a thing.
Yeah.
That's a situation that was happening.
Yeah.
And I remember just like being in the classroom with my 2 year olds, and, you know, I didn't understand why my circle time was always like, it always was chaotic. And I was like, why is my, like, why won't they just sit down and listen to me? Like, what's going on? And I'm like, well, yeah, dude, you planned like 5 things to do in a circle time with 2-year-olds. Like, yeah. Their attention span just isn't there. Yeah. Or I'd be confused at like, you know, I was trying to like talk to them during snack time, you know, trying to model conversations, and I'd ask them questions and they would respond with things like mommy and daddy. And I'm like, I didn't, like that's not, yeah. And I would just be like really confused. Like, why aren't they like having conversations? Why don't they talk to each other? What? And then, you know, I go through more early childhood development and theory and pedagogical things. And now I can pretty confidently explain like, oh yeah, that's why they're not doing that, because there's so many other things that are kind of going on in their developmental phase.
Yes.
You know, like, yeah, they're not ready to play with each other. They're playing next to each other. And that's just developmentally how they play at this stage. It's still
parallel
very valuable.
Play. Yes. Yes.
It's
they
still,
are learning.
They're learning so much. It's very valuable. They will get to that point and we can model it and we can show them and we can encourage it. But they're where they are in their terms of play right now is very normal, very fine. They're still learning.
that's the thing. The other big thing I think that's so important is play-based inquiry. And I think a lot of schools do not understand that. And I think that's where our children in our school system are struggling, because they don't have the ability to problem solve or to think critically, because they're just trying to pass these high-stakes tests, right? And that's what they're taught. You're taught the test so that you can pass the test so that my school can get money. It's, you know, simply said. But
yeah,
there's so much research showing that if I give a child a toy and I tell them, okay, these are the things, you push these buttons and this is what happens, and I give them the toy, they're going to just push those buttons and say, okay, yeah, and then they're done with it. But if I say, ooh, look at all these buttons. I wonder what they do. And I hand it to them, and then they can figure out, and they'll figure out even more things that I didn't know, because they're manipulating it or playing with it. And that inquiry-based learning is so important, whereas somebody outside might say, they're just playing with a toy. Like, what's the big deal, you know? But that integrated nature of that, and they're using motor skills, they're using vocabulary, you know, they might be using some science, because depending on the manipulation. So many things are happening in that one little interchange that I think a lot of other educators do not understand.
Yes. Yeah. No, I 100% agree. And, you know, I say this all the time, but I take the skills and the things that I've learned in child development, just human development in general, and it has been applicable to everything I've done in my life, you know, whether working at nonprofits, you know, whether I'm presenting at a conference, whether I'm networking, everything, you know, I do in my life, my knowledge of just how children learn, how people learn and what's going on, and just, it's so applicable to so many different aspects of life. And when I did my master's program, I did it in law, which seems random, but I swear there was a reason for it. But when I was doing it, I used my background and knowledge in human development to then kind of make these legal arguments of, well, yeah, when we're talking about juvenile justice, the reason why these don't work is because developmentally where they are, or the reason why we're seeing these behaviors is because as an adolescent, this is where they are developmentally. And it's like, we can't expect them to behave really any other differently, because that's just not, their brains aren't wired that way. Their brains are wired for right here, right now. Their brains are wired for what's going to feel good right here, right now. Rather, they're not thinking about their future in that same context. At least they're not doing it consistently enough, right? They might do it sometimes, but their brains aren't wired that way.
Right. But having that understanding, I agree with you, and I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no,
it just
good.
Makes me think of, so I used to teach in a master's program for child development. I taught some classes. And one of the classes I taught was attachment. And I don't know if you know who Dr. Bruce Perry is.
Yes.
Okay. So there was a book I used, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog. That's the name of the book. And it has these little scenarios of some of the patients that he's worked with. And one of them was a boy who was raised as a dog. But the other part, and what you said that triggered it for me, was when I was I did a year in New York at Columbia, mm-hmm. and I was working, my advisor at the time was a clinical psychologist, and we were working with Avira Juvenile Justice in mm-hmm. New York City, and we were working with youth that were incarcerated, and we were doing family therapy with them. And, you know, when they were in jail, we would bring the family to the jail, and we'd work with them in family therapy. But a lot of juveniles are lacking that attachment. And then when you add in foster care children, mm-hmm. it even gets extended more because mm-hmm. they don't have those attachments. And so there was one story in his book where there was a young woman that was in the foster system. She eventually had a child, but did not bond with the child. She did everything mm-hmm. right, where she took the child to the medical appointments and, mm-hmm. you know, fed the, but the child was not thriving.
Yeah.
And so interventions happened where she learned to attach to the baby and to learn to yeah. attach to an adult, and that baby started to thrive. But not yeah. understanding that as a juvenile, yeah. you know, I think we bring in our own context into our situations. Like, well, why can't you do this? Why can't you sit there? Why can't you yeah. listen?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that concept of the whole child, it does. It extends through our whole life and really looking at a whole person.
It
yeah.
does.
I use it on my husband all the time.
I use it in my relationship too.
So. Yeah. And he knows it. He's like, I know what you're doing.
Yeah. Yes. I do it with my friends. They yeah. hate me, but you know, they'll be like, oh, I'm going through this breakup or I'm going through this thing. And I'll start asking my strategic questions. And they're yes. like, oh, you're asking the questions again. I'm like, well,
yes,
they work, don't they?
Yes.
I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just asking questions yeah. strategically.
Yeah, that's right. You need to figure it out.
Yeah, you'll figure it out, but yeah. I'll just guide you along the yeah. way with some questions.
That's right.
That's I have right. one last question for you, sure. Dr. Kennedy, and that is, how do you reimagine education?
I just had this conversation with my husband yesterday, mm-hmm. and we really do need to overhaul our system in California. Yes. One of the issues, you know, I struggle with this because a lot of times it comes to politics, power, and money. Mm-hmm. And these districts spend millions of dollars on these box curriculum.
Yep.
And I don't know that there has been any really efficacious studies looking at the curriculum. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think most of us know, especially in early childhood, we know that handing a child a worksheet is really not appropriate for that child to yeah. learn. And yeah. and that's what's being done across our system. And I think we need to think of ways to teach children, yeah. even if we use, you know, I teach assessments, right? Earlier I mentioned mm-hmm. I'm like the assessment person in our program. Doing a lot with game-based assessments, I can give a child an iPad that's teaching the child math. And mm-hmm. whether the child speaks English or Spanish or Korean or Farsi, whatever mm-hmm. that child's language is, if I hand that child an iPad with a math game, they would be able to do that. Mm-hmm. But at the end, I would be able to see where that child is on math. And mm-hmm. as a teacher, that gives me so much information.
Yes.
But I'm not sitting there writing out on the board or, you know, on a transparency or on, you know, a whiteboard or yeah. something, things that I want them to copy that they don't mm-hmm. understand. So yeah. I think we need to overhaul our system and really, really look at something that incorporates. And again, in early childhood, we integrate teaching. Mm-hmm. If you're a teacher in a classroom, you can't just sit there and teach math in elementary in particular, right? You're
yeah.
you don't have the time in the day to just focus on one topic area. I might mm-hmm. have a science lesson that includes language and vocabulary, that includes some kind of social interactions with peers. it would incorporate and integrate all of these things. I think in early childhood, especially, the social emotional development and learning is part of our teaching. And then the classroom is also a teacher in early childhood.
It is.
When you go into a school district, that is not the case. Mm-hmm. You have a teacher who's the boss and they're dictating. Yep. And mm-hmm. regardless of how you learn, if you learn differently, too bad. You know, that type of thing.
Get on the train.
But it's not the teacher's fault. You know, I don't blame the teacher for that. And I know that young teachers, you know, I collected some data, but young teachers will go in with all these high hopes and all this knowledge. And then they're handed this curriculum and they're told, no, don't do what you want to do. You have to do this.
Yep.
And a really good teacher knows that that won't be the best way. So they will find ways to go around it to get the result. But it takes a lot of work. And you're not always rewarded for that. Sometimes you're reprimanded because you're not doing the testing at the times you're supposed to do it, because everything is, you know, scheduled out for you.
Yep.
And if you know your children are not where they need to be, so you're trying to build them up, you might delay your testing, but that's not what the schools want you to do.
They're trying to get that funding. So
yeah.
You and need so to do the thing so they can get the funding.
It's going to take legislation, honestly. I've learned that it's going to take some kind of legislation to do that. But the other part is I'm trying to write a grant to look at what's happening in schools, you know, TK in particular, but even looking at the different curriculum that's being used. Why is everyone in California so horrible at math? I don't understand it. I liked math. But I had good math teachers. At the end of the day, I tell my students, you're not bad in math. You've just had really bad math teachers.
Yeah.
So we reteach them math in our program, and they love math now when they graduate from us, because they understand it and they're able to teach children what they know. So there's so much about it. I think the way the system works is they focus so much on the subject matter. Mm-hmm. So take algebra, take statistics, you know, take science, but you don't know how to teach that. But you're qualified to teach it because you took it.
Basically, yeah.
I mean, that's how you pass the exam, and you can teach that, you know?
Yep.
So I think some of those things have to change. And the focus has to be on educators and educating more than just learning the subject.
Absolutely. More than just knowing the subject, knowing one, that developmental stage of who you're working with. I think when you're really proficient in that, you can teach them almost anything because you know where their brains are and you know how to talk to their specific brain. And you know exactly where these students are. And again, when we know development, we know that it's not very just strict and stringent. Just because you are 8 years old now, you should be able to do the checklist of these things.
Right.
We know that that's not how development works, right?
Right.
Just because you are this age, you know, you could be advanced in one area and behind in other areas. Like, we just kind of know developmentally a general idea of where you might be. And then you get to know the student and you get to know exactly where they are by getting to know them and getting to know how they learn and, you know, what things they learn best, and in really making learning fun. At that point, it just starts to become fun because, okay, I know this kid. I know my class. I know where they are developmentally. I know where I want them to be. Great. Now we can get to that end point, but we can get there in ways that are fun, that are appropriate, that engage them in new and novel ways. Like, bringing fun back into education.
Yeah.
Amazing.
But it's, you know, you ask any individual, you know, who is your favorite teacher? And they'll right off the bat have an answer for you. I don't know if it's just me, but I only remember a very select number of teachers in my whole K-12 system. There's a bunch of teachers I had. I couldn't recall their names for you because they were bad. They were bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel that. I think the teachers that stand out were the teachers that made it fun, that made it exciting, that made me want to learn things. Even things, I do like two classes on Shakespeare. I did not care about Shakespeare before, you know, I had the specific teacher, but then I had the specific teacher and he made learning so much fun that I ended up just taking other classes with this teacher because I was like, yeah, I'll take, let's learn about Shakespeare. Yes. I know way too much about Shakespeare right now. But it was so fun to learn these things. And now I have favorite Shakespeare plays. Like, it's amazing. But if you would have told me that, you know, years before, then I'm like, I don't care about Shakespeare. Like,
what am I going to do with that? Who's going to hire me? Right.
Right. What am I going to do with that information? But now I know a lot. And it was just really fun. It was exciting. And he taught it in just this way that spoke to the way that I learned. It was amazing. But thank you so much, Dr. Kennedy, for joining me. This has been an absolutely beautiful conversation. Where can my audience find you? Are you working on anything?
So I am at Cal Poly Pomona, and I'm in the Early Childhood Studies program. I'm actually the chair of the program. I think you have my email. Do you want me to say it here?
I can put all the contact information you'd like right in our show notes. So wherever you want. Yeah. Can do that.
So my email you have. I don't do social media. I honestly do not have the bandwidth and time to do that. I used to, but I do not anymore. And I'm also part of Peach. Peach is a collaborative. It's partnerships in education, articulation, and collaboration of higher ed. And so Peach started in LA County with all the community colleges and the CSUs and private institutions in early childhood programs. And we've been doing this since 2010. We have several work groups. Right now we have a work group that is working on the revision of the child development permit with CTC. So we have people on that. So we are collaborative. We're now statewide. We have a lot of people in Northern California and some in Central, not as many in the South, San Diego area. But we've met every month, since 2010. So it's been pretty long time. But we are doing a lot. You know, we have people on the CAIC policy division, and we do advocacy, and we do a lot of work with the California Department of Education and CTC and others to try to affect change. And we're stepping it up now with advocacy and trying to get to policymakers and try to get to legislators. So that's our next step.
Wow, that's amazing. And I'll link to all those great things in our show notes. So if you're curious to find out more about Peach or find out more about the programs, you can click on those links down there. Again, Dr. Kennedy, I want to thank you so much for joining me. This has just been an amazing conversation. I feel like I could talk to you for hours and days.
And you know, we'll do that.
Yay.
Yeah. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you for what you're doing. I really appreciate that.
Thank you so much. I love doing it, so I'm just going to keep doing it.
Yes, it's fantastic.
Thank you so much for tuning into Conscious Pathways. Please like, follow, and subscribe to Conscious Pathways wherever you get your podcasts. We're available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio. And if you like video podcasts, you can subscribe on YouTube and get notified every time I post a new podcast episode. And don't forget to share and leave a rating or review. It really does help the podcast to grow and reach more listeners just like you. And until next time, don't forget to navigate your conscious journey with courage and kindness. And I'll see you there for more transformative conversations in education. Bye.